This is Colourful Radio.
Now, indeed. I am very proud and very, very pleased to say we have the lovely Vince Cable. Woo!
It's funny because Vince is looking so bashful and kind of shocked by that kind of introduction. You're not used to getting that kind of introduction then.
No, but thank you very much for asking me anyway, and congratulations on your new station. That's great. Very positive, you know, in bad times when these things happen, it's great.
Thank you very, very much.
Exactly. And it's really good that we've got you in the studio today because economic and financial news are dominating the headlines. It used to be kind of on the margins of the mainstream news agenda. Now it's right at the centre. Looking at the front page of the BBC News website, HSBC in 12.5 billion fundraising plan. It's confirmed it's seeking to raise that money from shareholders through a new rights issue. Is that the kind of thing we want to see the big banks doing now?
Well, yes, they're looking after themselves and standing on their own 2 feet, which is what they should have been doing all along. But the extraordinary thing about Britain is that we are host to the world's biggest banks, HSBC. It has a balance sheet bigger than the British economy. The world's biggest bank, however, the Royal Bank of Scotland, NatWest, has gone down. It's effectively now being taken over by the state. But the fact that HSBC is managing its own affairs, is not relying on government to keep it going, is positive development, and they're going to their shareholders to raise more capital, and that's what we need to see.
So if any more banks come cap in hand to the government, they should be told, no, try and get it from your supporters, your shareholders.
Well, certainly that's the first line of defence. But if they have to come to the government, there has to be a proper deal. What's happened so far is the government's putting vast amounts of taxpayers' money into these banks. But it's not getting effective control. And we're in a kind of halfway house situation where the banks are continuing to operate in the old ways and they're looking after their shareholders' interests. But the government's putting all the money in. And this is where I think the government's lost the plot a bit. Mm-hmm. And they've got to take control of the banks. They've got to make absolutely sure that they're lending money to good companies, sound companies, which they're not doing at the moment. A lot of companies closing, can't even pay their wage bill. They've got to make sure that all this stuff about remuneration and pensions is sorted out. The greedy element has
got
to
be taken out. The shred thing.
Absolutely. But he's not the only one. No. And all kind of abuses are taking place. Massive tax avoidance scams are going on. The government's just got to intervene and stop it.
Going back to Fred the Shred briefly, obviously yesterday Deputy Leader of the Labour Party, Harriet Harman, told the BBC that he shouldn't expect to get the full amount of his pension because it's not going to happen. And I know you've been quoted as saying that the man has no shame, but is clawing any of this back realistic?
Well, I think it is realistic. I think we've got to separate out the kind of public outrage. Everybody's angry, you know. $700,000 a year for somebody who's 50-year-old, mm-hmm. hasn't even deserved it, has run his bank into the ground, you know, lost money for the shareholders, put a lot of people out of work, taxpayer bailing him out. Why is he getting this? I think people are just very angry. But it's one thing for us to flap our arms about and say this is terrible. The more practical question is, what do you do about it? I think that the simple solution actually is just for the government, through its directors on the board of RBS, simply not to pay it. I think what would be right to pay him is the amount of money he'd be entitled to if his company had gone bankrupt. If you're a bankrupt company, you are entitled to a pension under the government's pension protection scheme, and it would get $27,000. And if he objects to that, well, he can sue, can't he? And under the pensions legislation, a company can withhold a pension if somebody's been negligent, and I'm sure the government barristers could make out a case that there's plenty of negligence gone on here.
Well, yeah. I think so. My mum's been recently made redundant, and she didn't run her company into the ground, and she's not going to get anything like Fred the Shred.
Yeah.
Obviously.
That's it. And Vince, I've been watching a bit of television over the past few days, seeing a documentary, a couple of dramas about Margaret Thatcher, and then I was watching the Andrew Marr programme yesterday, saw the former BBC Director General Greg Dyke talking about the 30 years from 79 when Thatcher came to power to where we are now in 2009. He said it completed a cycle, the end of a certain kind of economics, you know, that kind of fairly unfettered style of economics. Is that what this credit crunch and this financial meltdown has left us with now? A different kind of economics?
Well, certainly that's partly true, and I think what's important about your question is that the world didn't suddenly fall apart a year ago. I mean, the seeds were being sown a generation ago. Mm. And if you look at policies that were introduced under Mrs. Thatcher, like converting the old building societies into banks, that's a very good example. The building societies were what we call mutuals. They were owned by their customers. They were pretty cautious, small-scale, community-based organisations mostly. and they were allowed to become banks. People got a windfall if they were a depositor, and they went on and became very greedy, very acquisitive. This is how Northern Rock started its problems, and HBOS, another Halifax, and that's at the heart of a lot of these difficulties. And the whole deregulation of the banking system opened up the way for banks to become world-scale organisations. You know, you had basically had high street banks teaming up with global casinos, which is what these investment banks were, and that introduced a lot of the instability. So we're going to have to get back. And of course, we can't reinvent the world. I mean, you can't put all the stuff back in the bottle. Mm-hmm. But we're going to have to recreate more discipline, financial
institutions. Tighter regulation.
But better regulation, not just more bureaucrats ticking boxes, but regulation that does actually avoid large-scale risk and the kind of collapse we've just seen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, without giving my political cards away, you were a Labour councillor back in the 70s, weren't you?
I was, yes. I lived in Glasgow and I represented Labour on the council there. And I, you know, I was proud of that kind of period of my life. I mean, the Labour movement had a lot of positive things going for it, and I was very much part of that.
Is there any chance of your political career going full circle, Vince?
No, there isn't. I mean, I left the Labour Party a quarter of a century ago when the Labour Party had a civil war, which you may remember, and it led to
the Gang of Four and all that.
Yes.
It's that Gang of Four and all that. And indeed, I joined the Liberal Democrats, and I'm very proud to be a member of the Liberal Democrats. I'm the deputy leader, and I think we've actually got the right balance. We do believe in fairness, social justice, like the left, but we also are very strong believers in individual liberties, in strong kind of local government, not centralising everything the way that Gordon Brown has. We're very environmental, I think, more than the other two big parties. And mm-hmm. we've steadily made progress. I mean, over the years, now got 63 MPs. We've built up a strong base in local government. So I think Liberal Democrats are very much the party of the future.
There are rumours that Gordon Brown wants you in his cabinet. You've heard those, have you?
I have heard them, and I'm quite happy in the party that I'm in, and I may well finish up in the cabinet, but it will be a Liberal Democrat one, I can assure you.
Oh, go back to your constituencies and prepare for government, as somebody once said.
That's what we've got to do. And I think in times of great economic upheaval, unexpected things happen politically. I mean, if you go back to the 1930s, of course, there were some very nasty things happened. You know, the fascists emerged. But at the same time, there was a big transformation. The Liberal Party, as it then was, basically died, and the Labour Party came up. And we can see that kind of thing happening again.
I knew you were the Shadow Chancellor, but I never actually realised you were the Deputy Leader till I looked up your website last night. Is that a job? A lot of people say it's a bit of a non-job being the Deputy Leader. What does it entail, aside from what would happen if the Leader stepped down?
Fell under a bus.
Fell under a bus,
well,
yeah.
The main task is eating vast quantities of rubber chicken. I go around the country meeting the troops in different parts of Britain and, talking to the party activists and so on, and that's quite an important role. It's not in the public eye, but it's important. And as you say, when the leader has a baby, as he did this week, I'm in the firing line.
Okay, I didn't actually know he'd had a baby.
Oh, yes. Okay. Baby Miguel.
Right. Miguel.
You are far more high profile, some might say, than your leader even.
Well, I think that's probably temporary because I speak on economic matters. I've got something to say. The Liberal Democrats have got a good line on this economic crisis. Mm-hmm. I mean, we got it right from the very beginning. So I'm in the public eye because I comment on that. But I think as the general election approaches, you don't regret these things. I mean, there was a mood at the time that, you know, the younger generation had got to take over. I was in my 60s and we'd had a leader who was actually very good, but he was brutally taken apart by the media, who depicted him as a kind of walking skeleton. I mean, it was absolutely dreadful.
Yeah.
And certainly my colleagues felt that, you know, young guys are needed to lead a party. But I've found a role in this economic crisis, and I've got something to say, and I'm very happy doing it in the role I've got. I'm not pining for the mantle of leadership.
Yeah, and you talk not just about that, but also about civil liberties and freedoms, and, of course, 75th anniversary of Liberty just last week, and a series of big conferences up and down the country, and you were at one of them here in London, I think.
Yes, it was a marvellous event, actually. There were literally hundreds of people who came along to the Institute for Education in London, talking about different aspects of liberty. And it was a cross-party thing, and people one would never have dreamed would be there, you know, from the Tories, who in the past were not very good on
people
this
like David Davis, former Shadow Home Secretary.
Who've stood up and said all the right things about ID cards and DNA testing and so on. So they were there, and we were happy to share a platform with them. So it was a very cheering occasion. I think what I got out of it was that people are beginning to realise that in this very nasty economic slump that we've got, a lot of our traditional civil liberties could now be at risk because people are going to get very angry. You know, people lose their job, hundreds of thousands. Students are going to leave university, half of them not got jobs, and the anger's going to build up and people want to express it. And yet we've got this very repressive legislation now, which means that if you demonstrate, you can be accused of breaking anti-terrorist laws. And I think there's a potential for serious trouble here.
Summer of Rage, the police were calling it.
Definitely. Now, Mr. Cable, you are our last guest, obviously, of our first DAB show. Uh-huh. And we wanted to have a little bit of fun. Now, we did intend to do this with all the politicians that came in, but sadly, I forgot about it.
This sounds ominous.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the thing is, you're fantastic on the economy and you're loved across all the parties. So I don't think you getting these questions wrong would dent in any way your image.
Sounds if I will.
Let's have a check. It's a reality check quiz. So we want to see how in touch our politicians are in 2009 in credit crunch times. So do you want to...
You go for it, Gigi.
I'll go for it then, okay. So, first question. How much does 2 pints of milk cost? These are averages, okay? How much do you think 2 pints of milk will cost you today in your supermarket?
Well, I buy mine at the little newsagents across the road and it costs me about 90.
Very
good.
Probably
cheaper in the supermarket.
86p cool. Not bad. So you support your local newsagent, or is that laziness, right? Not going to the supermarket?
It is a bit of laziness, yeah. But no, I do support the local shops. You've got to do that.
Okay. Do you live in your constituency, by the way?
I do, right in the middle of it. I live 100 yards from the Rugby Union Stadium, which is
brilliant.
Part of Twickenham, of course.
Okay. Moving on. How much is a box of 6 free-range eggs?
Oh, no, you've got me here. I would guess about £1.50, but I may be wrong. Badly wrong here.
Not badly wrong. £1.29.
Okay.
Not bad, not bad. How much is a daily travel card, do you think? Peak, I don't know what that means. Off-peak. Peak travel card or off-peak. You can give me whichever.
Well, how many zones?
I've got an annual season ticket, so I don't use the daily travel card, but it must be, what, £5?
£5.60 off-peak. Okay. Yeah, not bad,
not
bad.
Let's give him that, yeah.
We'll give him that. And how much, I'll give you three more, how much is a single bus ride using your Oyster card?
Well, again, I don't have an Oyster card, but was it £1, £1.20?
£1. You're too good.
It's not working.
He's brilliant. All right, one more. I'll need to catch you out. How much do you think a bag of standard eating apples costs?
How much in it? How many pounds?
Oh, come on. Just a standard bag of eating apples. I've got no idea.
Cooking apples.
I'll guess. £2.
£1.89. I mean...
You know what? This has been a disaster, but great for Vince.
Well, at least clap and pretend.
I'm clapping. Vince Cable, will you come in and see us again? Because we're not very far away from the House of Commons.
Sure, no, I'd love to. I like what you're doing. I like the music you're playing. So, yeah.
Really? Tell us about... Are you a soul head?
Not really. I'm really classical, but I've got broad tastes and a good melody, good rhythm. I'll always be up there dancing to it when I can.
Good melody and good rhythm on here. But I asked you this last time, and now we're on DAB, and I can actually get some real people behind this. Are we any nearer to you being on Strictly Come Dancing?
I don't think so. I think they've got a bar on politicians. You know, you can imagine the problems they all want to be on. But, yeah, it would be fun. And I'd certainly take it on if I was asked.
And when you saw Lord Peter Mandelson dancing with Strictly Judge Arlene Phillips at the Channel 4 Political Awards, were you impressed? Were you intimidated?
I was surprised. I thought it was all talk. But he seemed to have a certain amount of style.
He did. He did. Well, hopefully, when you retire, God forbid, if the programme's still going, you can get on then.
Okay, great.
You can partner Juju. Wonderful. Vince, thank you very much.
Thanks very much. It's
been a pleasure having you here.
This is Colourful Radio.